With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
If you've got cigarette-smoking assassins or creepy serial killers outside your house, you know you better be insured to the teeth. That's why this week's sponsor of the Bloom Files is our friends over at Geico. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. And I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com. Truth is out there, and here, who knows? But either way, we're opening up the Bloom Files here on Post Show Recaps, an X-Files rewatch slash first watch podcast. Hello, everybody. Mike Bloom here, breaking down two very interesting standalone episodes of the X-Files. You hear that voice chuckling next to me. We are the two voices that you were overhearing, much like a certain cigarette-smoking man overheard Mulder and Scully talking, I guess. Angela Bloom, was that the first version of a podcast?
Maybe. Them bugging the everywhere.
Him. Maybe that's what it was that he wanted to pass the time. And so he thought, let me put
just
on a podcast.
Just listen to these cool tapes.
Yeah, my own The X-Files podcast starring Mulder, Scully, and special guest The Lone Gunman.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's possible.
Yeah, so we're breaking down two episodes today. We're breaking down Season 4, Episode 7, not Season 3, Episode 7, Musings of a Cigarette-Smoking Man, Season 4, Episode 10, Paper Hearts. I mean, this really does feel like hallmarks of a series that has kind of like found its footing in a manner of speaking.
Totally.
Not to say that it's been stumbling the first three seasons, but considering that we're about to get into one episode that is just like a flat out deep dive into one of its most mysterious characters, and then the other one, which is just, hey, remember all that stuff you learned? Maybe it's not true.
Yeah, that and also, like, this is sad. So, but the first one's, like, sad in a different way. It's, like...
It's more, tragic?
Yeah, it's just, like, this guy's life, man.
It's pitiful. Well, is it his life is the question.
Yes.
That's the big thing to take away, because that's something you really reminded me of as we get into Musings of a Cigarette-Smoking Man, is that, to your point, yeah, you might get a sense of pity and or, like, a sense of danger around the cigarette smoking man, but it should be couched the entire time in, was it Frohickey who says, like, oh yeah, I read this out of a magazine.
Yes, and that they did some investigating. The lone gunman had been investigating him, and this is what they found out. So, I mean, I think you're supposed to take away that, yes, most of it is true, but that some of it could be fabricated, especially like the later scene where they're all sitting around the table and
and then saying like, we're going to do this. And
Saddam Hussein calls.
Saddam Hussein's on speed dial. Let's fix the Oscars. I mean, I think if anyone watches one episode of The X-Files with the belief that like, oh, the government has a control and the Illuminati is real.
Like, yeah, this was like a...
This is their credo right
here. Yeah, but that's like exactly what the lone gunman thinks. So it's very much so in line with that. But I mean, we'll talk about it in the sense that maybe it all happened. Because I don't want to get too meta about it.
No, I mean, I think it's very Jose Chung's From Outer Space where the proper story is going to be some sort of mix of the narrative that's been presented to us.
But all we have is what we saw.
All we have is what we saw, and we're going to get into what we have to see. So we open on a quote here from Henry IV, so highbrow, for nothing can seem foul to those that win. Essentially, like, history is written by the winners. They can do no wrong.
I mean, it's not untrue.
Not untrue, though I feel like, hopefully, nowadays, when we're trying to explore narratives from many different angles.
Yes, I do think we're a little bit more aware that history was written by the winners today, whereas in the past, it was kind of like, it was a narrative that they didn't really realize.
Surprise, surprise, Angela has. This episode opens, I'm confused, because... So the cigarette smoking man is, as we mentioned, sort of spying on... Mulder and Scully meeting with the lone gunman.
The cigarette smoking man, you're meant to believe, is always spying on them. Is right. Constantly has everything bugged.
Doesn't he have a life?
No. And you see that very clearly.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Mulder does visit him at home and he barely has anything.
And in this episode, I mean, the end of the episode when it's Christmas and he's basically like, I am going to go home and write my novel, which is just the saddest thing ever.
Yeah, shout out to all the writers out there. But I was confused more so from a location basis, because to me, the windows he was positioned outside looked a lot like the set they used when they went to Hong Kong.
I'm sure it was.
To take down Krycek. So I was like, wait, are we... Because we know...
There's also an episode where Mulder and Scully are on surveillance, like, for their...
Oh, no. Mulder was, like, going back to surveillance already?
Yeah, like, that was, like, the one of the beats that they were on, because there was, like, a like some... Because sometimes they get assigned file cases that have nothing to do with the X-Files. Like, they're just on some
random... Oh, interesting. So just, well, you have a week off, so you might as well do some grunt FBI
No,
work.
I think it's more like they know that Mulder is an excellent profiler, and
yeah,
Scully
we'll
like...
get into that with the second
and
episode.
Scully is, like, a really good agent, so sometimes they're pulled into things without, like, them necessarily wanting to be. So, yeah, in a few episodes, I forget when it happens, but there's definitely an episode where they're doing surveillance and, like... you see that same location.
I also thought for a second, oh, he's setting up a camera, but no, he was very clearly setting up a sniper rifle.
Yeah, so what
right?
I think happened is that he always has them bugged, and he knows that Rohickey and the lone gunman are investigating him, so he's gonna like take them out, maybe.
Yeah, but before he does, he's gonna essentially listen to his life story, or is it? And so. We flash back. Well, first we find out about his dad, right?
Yeah, so his dad was a communist spy.
Yes, who was executed. Due to espionage. I'm assuming the whole, like, well, I don't know.
The Red Scare type thing.
I was going to say, how I'm thinking about how old he is. Like, does that relate to the whole J. Edgar Hoover Red Scare
thing? I think so, at least around that time. And then...
His mother was a heavy smoker, surprise, surprise, and died of lung cancer before he could
eat.
Yes,
which is a big point in the story.
Yeah, like Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr style, was orphaned basically at a very young age.
Yeah, and then grew up in the Midwest, like from orphanage to orphanage, and then we sort of flash forward to him in the army.
Yep, and so here we go. And
1962.
What I really love about this, I think so. It's the 60s at least, because it's in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And, yeah, I mean, it's going to definitely be before November 22nd, 1963.
And he talks to his friend, a fellow soldier.
Yeah, but I really love the structuring of this episode. Like, I like the fact that, speaking of the meta aspect, we're almost doing this in acts, right? That each act has a title to it. It's like a play almost.
Well, and I think that's supposed to reference to his sort of ambitions of being a novelist. Mm-hmm. It's like chapter one, like, this is this part of my life. And then chapter two, you know, so I think it's supposed to reference that.
Yeah, though I will say the chapter titles maybe leave a little bit to be desired. You know,
they love to do that.
Well, like one's a quote, right? Things really didn't go well at Dealey Plaza. Then we have part two is just down the road a ways from Graceland. Mm-hmm. Not a sentence. Part three, the most wonderful time of the year.
Yeah.
And then part four is just the X-Files.
Yeah.
So it feels like the titles don't really have a concrete structure.
No, but
them.
They're just telling you what's happening in this part of his life.
I mean, when you hear Dealey Plaza also, you know what's going to be involved.
Yeah. Well, the first time I saw this episode too, I was like, wow, they're really going hard at this, like conspiracy theory stuff.
Yeah, because I mean, that's one of the big things for, to be honest.
Well, and we'll get to it, but they even show like, oh, the grassy knoll and the guy with the umbrella, and
yeah,
it's
I mean,
like all connected.
I mean, if the X-Files, I know that there were episodes that took place after 9/11, but I feel like if the series started after 9/11, I kind of feel like they might include something like that in here. You know?
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. But
because it feels like that and the JFK assassination were like the two big conspiracies of, oh, were the government involved?
Well,
were there two shooters?
Like, the JFK assassination was like a cosmic shift in the way that Americans thought and felt and, you know, organized themselves and just, you know, were more aware of things after that point. It was very much so like a change in the, like, I guess the demeanor of America,
like the climate.
Yeah. And the same thing happened on 9/11. But I do think that this was like such a huge deal that we just can't relate to because we weren't there.
Yeah, so we open here that, yeah, the cigarette smoking man has found himself in the army talking about going to...
Sometimes the X-File does... They,
kicking his rang-dang-do.
Yeah, sometimes they do a little bit too much, like in the way of nodding to the audience, like winking at the audience. Like this part with Bill Mulder being like, hey, and here's a picture of my son, isn't he a cutie? Like, it's like, okay.
Yeah, but apparently Fox Mulder's first word was JFK.
Yes, JFK. Also, creepily, apparently, the cigarette smoking man holds onto this photo.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by that, because, yeah, this is the only glimpse I think we get of young Bill Mulder. Their paths are going to cross a lot, obviously, as we find out, but evidently
not in this
story.
Yeah, later on, when he joins the State Department, but it's like, I don't think it was necessary to include him here, because, like, they know each other later. Why do they also need to know each other before he became, like, a secret espionage man?
Yeah, so in this instance, he's kind of a dweeb. Right, he's saying, I refuse to see the Manchurian candidate. He says, I couldn't touch the cigarette. Like, really
goody two-shoes. Yeah, he's a goody two-shoes, exactly. Like, he prefers the novel to the movie. And he also is like, immediately called in to what is, we assume, members of the syndicate, early mm-hmm. members of the syndicate.
Ooh.
And he is basically asked to go on a mission to kill JFK. But by saying that, I guess, like... In this part, they talk about him being part of other missions. So he's a goody two-shoes, but he's also already done stuff like this in the past.
Yeah.
Confidential, well, you can't talk about it ever again missions.
Sort of. And there's also this idea, right, when they talk about his dad as well. This mm-hmm. general sort of paints this picture of, you know, people like to control life events to ensure a more positive experience for everybody. And there are extraordinary men who shoulder the burden of the world. And your father... was one of those men. He just was working for the wrong person, essentially.
Yeah, but right when he walks in, they ask him, like, do you know about this? And he's like, no. Were you part of this? And he's like, no.
Right, yeah, he was part of, like, an assassination.
Because he was denying.
South America.
Yeah, so basically he's done this before, and now it's gotten to the point where he's going to really do something for them in the sense of killing JFK, and from that moment on, he will no longer be anybody. Like,
right,
they're going to erase him.
Yeah, it's interesting, right, because you... It's really painted as this is the moment where he breaks bad. But to your point, I mean,
he's been doing it for some time.
He's been letting some blood for a while.
Well, and I think that's more so the fact that he's just like belongs to the army, belongs to the whatever, quote unquote, like America. And now he's going to sort of fall in a little bit deeper.
Yeah. So he's given his assignment, right? Assassinate JFK, because the general vocalizes that. You know, the government feels like he got them dangerously close to nuclear war in the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah, he made some mistakes, basically.
Right. And there's a fun little moment here where he says, oh, is there a cover story? And you have that, like, little, you know,
we have
in the corner being like, tell him it was men from outer space.
Yeah, that was dumb. And then he's like, we've identified a patsy.
Yeah.
Lee Harvey Oswald.
And so he's going to meet with him a little bit. I mean, after reading 112263, I just, like, can't get that stuff out
of my
head.
Did you watch any of that?
I didn't watch
it. It was pretty good.
Yeah?
It was pretty good, but it was hard. It was, when I was watching it, it was coming out weekly, and I need to binge it.
I know, it was the weird Hulu thing, right?
Yeah.
Where they were going to try weekly. I don't know. I
couldn't get on board with that.
I really actually enjoyed the book. It was one of those very... long Stephen King novels,
yes.
But I enjoyed a lot of it.
Yeah, a little meandering. But I mean, this was a little meandering too. I think there's a lot of detail that needs to be uncovered here that they really breeze by.
Yeah,
like,
well, the two of them are meeting, right? There's a little, again, another wink, wink, nod, nod to being like, don't
basically
smoke.
Basically, somebody has told Lee Harvey Oswald something about, you know, like, basically, like, he's supposed to place the gun.
Yeah,
that's all he thinks.
All he's supposed to do is plant the curtain rods, quote unquote, which is to mean, like, the rifles.
Yeah.
And then he gets, in exchange, free passage to Cuba.
Yeah, which is, like, weird. So basically, he thinks he's working for communism.
Yeah, essentially. Like, this is, like, a communist plot.
Yes, which it's definitely not. But
And meanwhile, the cigarette smoking man is going to be the true assassin. It seems like he's going to go through the sewers, speaking of Stephen King.
Well, there is a moment before that, just before we get to that, where Lee Harvey Oswald just offers him a cigarette, and he's like, no, don't touch him. I never touch the things.
Well, I think he also brings up, right, that study of, like, oh, there's studies, you know, that say that
yes.
things can kill you now.
Yeah. And he's, like, very much so against cigarettes. But, I guess he goes to the sewer. He arrives in a public works van. So, yeah, he goes to the sewer.
Yeah, he's got a pretty good shot, it seems, from the sewers.
It actually looked like quite a difficult shot because it's like up.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Like he had a surprisingly good angle
at
JFK's car. But he's not alone. There, you know, they had that guy with the umbrella.
Yes.
Right?
Like, which is like, and all of these things are like, you can imagine the lone gunman telling the story like, oh yeah. And then, you know, the guy with the umbrella, you know, the Grassy Knoll story, like all of it's connected.
Exactly.
Like
magic,
that.
Magic bullet, et cetera.
Yeah. So anyway,
Harvey Oswald gets a soda.
He gets a soda and then he, basically is, I guess, framed for it. And
yeah, he realizes, like,
he goes back to his apartment. There is no passport. There is no nothing. He's like, I'm not going to be a patsy, but he ends up being a patsy.
And he ends up being a Patsy Cline. I mean, he tries to, he goes out guns blazing quite literally when he, when like two cops just like pull him aside, he shoots one of them.
Yeah, basically, he's like, I don't want to go to jail.
And he runs into the movie theater, because before the cigarette smoking man said, like, oh, I like going to the movies. It helps pass the time.
He basically tells him where he's going to be in case something goes wrong, which in retrospect is actually him telling him where he should be when it does go wrong, because he knows it will go wrong.
Yeah.
So that he can get arrested.
And so to that point,
he
was going to be there, he tipped off the cops to it. Or maybe Lee Harvey Oswald just drew a lot of people because he shot a police officer.
Well, no, I think it was more so the fact that like they were tipped off that he was there.
And so he just menacingly lights up a cigarette.
Yep, he takes out the pack of cigarettes that Lee Harvey Oswald had, and then he's such, so it begins. And
so it begins. You kill a president, screw it.
Well, I do think that probably would change you.
a little bit. Again, like you said, such a momentous shift for everyone. American.
Yeah.
I'd imagine he's included in that.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, he's like so sweaty when he's in that movie theater too. So like, he's clearly like not the hardened criminal that he will be.
Part two. And we are now in black and white.
Yeah, I honestly couldn't. When it moved to black and white, I was like, wait, was it black and white in the beginning too?
I was going to say, where's Michael Bublé? I feel like every time we go to black and white and X-Files, he's there.
Yeah, I recall this whole episode being in black and white, so I don't know.
That, I feel like that makes more sense, but maybe they wanted to show, like, the idea that, like, his world was in color and now it's in black and white or something. Or maybe it's just a simple matter of, we're going to get into the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., and this whole black versus white issue as well.
Plus, they use a lot of, like, found footage in these episodes, so it's...
Yeah, they use a lot of, like, the photos of...
Yeah, so it's possible, because those were in black and white, then they made it in black, I don't know. I'm sure somebody will tell us.
Yeah, but the one thing we do find out before we jump into yet another assassination is that he's at a little tippy typewriter, and he's writing some novels.
Take a Chance, The Jack Colquitt Adventure.
Yeah, Jack Colquitt. That's not...
Colquitt.
Yeah, that's a bad detective name.
I mean, it's clearly a bad book.
Yeah, I know, like, Jason Bourne, you know, like... Yeah.
But you know what? He's not a good author. Raoul Bloodworth.
Yeah, I do like Raoul Bloodworth. I think that's a fun pen name.
Yeah.
I think Raoul Bloodworth should have been the name of the adventurer. Just switch the author's name and the character name.
Yeah, so he's writing this novel, which is, like, clearly a sort of thriller-esque type situation, and he's listening to the radio, and he hears Martin Luther King Jr. give a speech.
Yeah.
Which basically... I guess signs his death certificate.
Yeah, because basically we see that now
he's taking it too far.
Fully in with the conspiracy. He's like sort of conspiring with J. Edgar Hoover, and they're basically trying to come up
socialism.
With all these things they can do to like stymie the growing civil unrest existing in the country. And Cigarette Smoking Man basically says, "Well, we're going to kill him."
Yeah, because he basically is inciting revolution.
Yeah, that's what he feels like. They're trying to raise a black army to ignite a civil war, and this is where Cigarette Smoking Man also sort of takes the general's rhetoric, right? When he says, oh yeah, he's an extraordinary man.
Well, so what he says is that he really does value what he thinks, and he thinks that he is somebody who has like really great principles, and he embodies everything, but that he recognizes that as he grows more popular and unrest continues, that it might actually inhibit their chances at winning the Vietnam War if he encourages black people not to enroll in the army.
Well, that's what he essentially calls them, a communist, right? Then by proxy.
Yeah, because they, and also there's all these like money-making military endeavors too.
The general in that first scene calls communism like the greatest threat in human history or something.
Yeah, so basically they're going to kill him.
Yeah, and so, well, it's interesting because I feel like Cigarette Smoking Man is actually going a little rogue here, right? Like
he volunteers.
He volunteers, but he also like leads his partner off the trail, right? Distracts him so that he is the one to sneak in the bushes and take the shot.
Yeah. Well, I think he wants to make sure it's done properly and there are no witnesses and nobody can like, you know, I don't know, do something to get him in trouble.
You mentioned this before, but this is when we see a cigarette smoking man holding that picture of Mrs. Mulder and Little Fox raises so many questions.
Well, we know that they had some kind of affair.
Yeah, but did they have like multiple prints of that? Did he take that off of Bill Mulder?
He must have taken it off of Bill Mulder because it's like an old timey photo. You don't make multiple prints back in the day.
Yeah, was he just like, give me that, boom, let me borrow that wallet photo you got there, bud.
He probably just stole it. Like, he's a creep.
Yeah, just, especially again, if what was alluded to with Mrs. Mulder a few episodes ago is indeed verified.
Yeah, like, he's a creep.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Love looking at the family of the guy.
And
I'm,
you know,
cuckolding.
What? It's his own fault then, because his novel's rejected.
Yep. So after the assassination number two, he basically gets a letter saying, like, not even just like,
no,
reject.
Like, you're this a bad author.
The ultimate rejection says, burn the book. Yeah. The ending is lame. Your writing is bad.
Yeah. Like, you're not good at this. Stop doing it.
Yeah. I'm assuming that the X-Files fans just like went on to, I guess they're like alt.tv/X-Files and like just took criticism of their own writing and applied it here.
Probably. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, there's probably, whenever you're writing about writers, you'd have to imagine like there's always a prime opportunity to poke fun at yourself or
at
the world of writing.
I do think that publishers can be notorious, especially at that time, for, you know, being really, I guess, like, jaded.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who have put out right those letters from publishers that rejected them in the past.
Yeah, and also I think that there was a stigma that publishers were people who didn't make it as writers, and then, you know, so like
those who can't do publish.
Exactly. There's like a whole like rhetoric behind that. So I think maybe it's pulling on that. Not that it's true. I mean, to any of our publisher listeners out there, who the heck knows? But in 1962 or whatever it was.
Yeah, we should also mention that this little segment ends with, so is this Ted Kennedy?
Yes, that's Ted Kennedy speaking.
Speaking about the death of Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. And he ends up quoting Aeschylus, and so is the cigarette smoking man.
Yeah, because he like knows it by heart, which is wild.
To imply that like he's also behind Ted Kennedy's death?
Maybe. I think that it's...
Was that just like, oh, he found his next victim?
Yeah, you said that, but I never thought that, but it's possible.
Yeah, and both episodes, actually, we're dealing with a person who, likes to kill a lot.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, I don't know if he likes it, but he feels like he has the ability through these assassinations to turn the tide of like, the way history is happening. You know, he can make things happen through assassination.
All right, here we are. Part three, the most wonderful time of the year. We jump all
1991.
Big jump forward.
Yeah, we jump from the young Mulder or the young cigarette smoking man now to who we know as the cigarette smoking
man.
And
a little bit of a leap in time forward, but also probably a leap in logic as well. Right.
This is the part that made me think like, oh, this is all being definitely told by the lone gunman.
Yeah, so essentially, the cigarette smoking man is now leading a meeting of yes men, with the news items being like, ah, yes, we've got the Anita Hill scandal.
The controversy there.
Done. Oh, the Rodney King
trials
are happening, and Saddam Hussein is on standby.
And he says the Buffalo Bills cannot win the Super Bowl.
Yeah, which is, there's an interesting fact from that. So I guess the actor who plays the cigarette smoking man was like entirely confused as to why he was so fixated on
the
preventing
Buffalo
the Buffalo
Bills
from winning the Super Bowl. Like, I think it's one of those things where maybe he didn't get it was a joke.
Yeah.
But he's like, so apparently he like called
the
Chris
writers
Carter and
oh,
was,
Chris
like,
Carter.
He was like, can you just tell me like why he would want that to happen, considering that he's assassinated people and
I think
now
it's
he's just
like,
so fixated on it? I think it's just a joke.
Well, I also think it's like meant to be like that's what he cares about. Is the Super Bowl winning, not murdering historical figures, you know, like
he's also working on next month's Oscar nominees.
Yeah, exactly.
Who and are the Oscar nominees in
1991?
Let's look it up. Let's see.
But yeah, I feel like it's meant to be like that. It's so outlandish that like you would think, you know, why would he care about that?
All right, so it looks like, this was the year the Dances with Wolves won. So maybe the cigarette smoking man was just a big fan of Kevin Costner.
It's possible.
That was also when Kathy Bates won for Misery. I feel like you get a lot of pleasure out of Misery, right? It's about a writer.
It is about a writer. What else?
Joe Pesci won for Goodfellas. Oh, Whoopi Goldberg won for Ghost. That might be X-Files type of thing, right?
Yeah, well, she was great in Ghost.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. But maybe he's like, oh, I like this. I work in the spooky stuff.
Maybe.
You know?
No, but he says he doesn't care. He's like, I don't give a shit. Like,
he also reveals that apparently the Miracle on Ice was fixed.
Yeah, he was like, they drugged a Soviet goaltender with a needle. A needle?
There was Novocaine within a false wedding ring that, like, they patted the goalie on the shoulder or something.
Yeah, a pin needle.
And then injected him with Novocaine so he missed that final goal.
Wild.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, yeah, communism. they got theirs.
Speaking of spooky, actually, I do believe that the spooky kid is, the Mulder's name is invoked, right? He's like, oh, yeah,
it is.
Get that spooky kid on it.
Which is, I think this episode is also written by the same people who are, right?
Yeah, I believe it was Glenn Morgan.
Glenn Morgan and...
James Wong, I think?
Yeah, I don't remember. But either way, the same people.
The ones who wrote the two episodes last time.
The same people who like to call him spooky.
Yeah, exactly. So they bring that back. But yeah, this is when we get like a really sad look at Cigarette Smoky Man's life. We start with, as you mentioned before, like he essentially gets invited to go have Christmas with his coworkers. And he's like, no,
I have to go visit family. And they're like, clearly, no, that's not true.
And as a present, he gives them the same dumb tie.
Yeah.
He has to be by far one of the worst gift givers.
So bad.
Yeah, because like there's barely any care put into it. And it's also all the same thing.
He doesn't care.
Yeah. But what he does care about is his manuscript. Like he is devoting himself to that to the point where he has now worked on another novel called Second Chance. Right.
Yeah, basically like the same character, like series, I guess.
Yeah, well, because I think at this point he is sort of trying to think about like, is this what I really want to do with my life?
Yeah, well, I think he would prefer to be a novelist, but he's not getting anywhere with that.
Exactly. So he's thinking like, what if this person had a chance to like do their life over and not make the choices that they did?
Yeah, but no.
He's called away on business.
Yeah, we see Deep Throat.
Deep Throat and Ronald. His name got revealed here. Old Ron.
Old Ron gives him a call. And basically, this is the episode where they find the spacecraft in the first season of The X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
This is, he basically says, like, he meets him near the site of a UFO wreck.
Do you assume this is, like, the first time that they've encountered this?
Yes. I mean, they know it exists. It's been going on, the conspiracy, for a while now. But this is the first time that they've... captured one, I guess.
Right, because I mean, that's when, you know, Deep Throat goes into this whole monologue, right, saying, you know, tonight the course of human history will be set by two men standing in the shadows. So this really does seem magnanimous.
Yeah, and they talk about this, how they've changed history so many times, and this is just another instance of that, but, you know, a little bit more intense, because basically, and this is a true thing, that there is like a, I don't want to say unspoken, but an agreement between all, like, so all countries on Earth that anyone who finds so it like a crashed UFO and there's life, they're supposed to kill it.
Mm,
like it's like a common like known trope.
I did not know this trope.
Well, you don't study UFOs.
I don't. I'm the Scully.
No, but it's something that's done in like, I don't know if it's like a real, but it's real in the sense that it's outside of the X-Files, a thing that has been talked about.
Yeah. And so they invoke it here, right? Saying that, okay, we have to kill the alien. The question is, who is going to do it? Deep Throat initially says, you know, I'm the liar, you're the killer.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, you've killed some people too. And he's, and you know, they've all basically done lying and killing.
So right, they got to flip a coin.
So they have to flip a coin. And it turns out that Deep Throat is the one to do it.
Yeah. So, I mean, they kill this alien, basically.
Yeah.
But you see it. You see a full-blown alien.
You see an alien, like, on
which
life
is, again,
support.
Why it's like, okay, maybe this is something being told by Frohicke. You know, like, they never want to show you outright anything.
Part 4, The X-Files. And oh boy, is it The X-Files, because we started
flashback.
We have some old footage here, like old school Scully. The hair really gives it away,
it
right?
Sure does. Where although this first episode, her hair is great, and then the second episode, it's not. Like, the pilot is amazing.
Right. And so we see, remember that he was in the background with Blevins when they were assigning Scully to The X-Files.
And then he eavesdrops on their first meeting.
Yeah. Exactly. And then we flash forward, and it turns out, you know, Frohicke calls him the most dangerous man alive,
mm-hmm.
but he also ruminates, you know, the only person he can escape is himself. So it's like, yeah, he's dangerous, but he's also a sad sack of a human being.
Yeah, exactly. But we also, did we skip over the fact that he does get his novel published?
Yeah, so this is right after this, where he's going to get a call, essentially, from this publishing house that says that they love the story.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that I think he decided to make his new Raoul Bloodhound, or whatever his name was, he made his novel a little true to life, right? He's talking about alien assassinations.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going a bit more sci-fi than thriller.
Yeah, and it's
going
to be basically serialized in a magazine, and he has to like pay for it, which is like a huge sign that it's a scam.
Exactly. He has to pay $25. I'm honestly surprised that A, this magazine existed, and B, like they actually did publish it.
Yeah, no, it's true. But
they could easily take his $2,500 and his like.
But there are things out there that exist like this today. I mean, there's poetry books, mm-hmm. there's things that
Reader's Digest.
Yeah, that you submit your stuff for, but you do have to pay for it to be like published, which is like wild that people still fall for that kind of stuff. And it's actually like very upsetting. But
yeah, I mean, Cigarette Smoking Man sinks his entire future into this pulpy magazine,
right? He's so adamant that this is like, it's all he's been waiting for.
Yeah, I mean, he types up his letter of resignation after years and years in the position that he's in to say, I'm finally going to move on. I get to do what I want to do.
And during this time, he also has, we forgot to mention, right from when they were around the board table, has been having patches on his neck.
Oh, right, yeah.
So I think that he is off and on again trying to quit smoking.
Right, and I think that's a symbol as well of him, like, trying to leave this behind.
Trying to have, like, something more to his life, have meaning, I guess.
But unfortunately, the path he wants to go to on is a dead end, because his story's essentially been butchered.
Yeah, they basically, like, took the story and just, like, rewrote it and put it in the magazine.
Yeah, the ending's completely different, and he kind of realizes that it's for kind of a shitty magazine.
Yeah. And if somebody was, the guy he's buying it from is like, why would anyone pay for that?
Yeah. And it looks like he's going to kill him for a second.
It does look like that.
But instead he just pays for the magazine.
Yeah.
He'd really be like Lee Harvey Oswald in that regard. But we get, what I really like about this episode as well is that it really is like a bastardized take on Forrest Gump.
Yeah. Right? We're sitting on the bench.
Well, it's also the whole episode is of watching him go through all these historical events, just less CGI on John Lennon's face. But here he is sitting on the bench. Life's like a box of chocolates, you know, a cheap perfunctory gift that nobody asks for. And he says occasionally you get the peanut butter cup, but usually it's going to be jellied candy and teeth cracking nuts, and you're just end up with an empty box.
Yeah, it's like very just depressing.
Yeah, and also, you know, he's sitting on the bench next to like a homeless man, mm-hmm. right? This is some nice lady waiting for the bus.
Just a homeless man.
Yeah. Well, Spencer had a quote about that. He said that this was his favorite scene, but what I didn't like was showing him gunning down historical figures left and right with apparent ease and giving the impression that he had his hands in so many cookie jars of events, speaking of sweets, or of historical significance. What is most egregious is that the events of this episode completely disregard the timeline established by the apocrypha cold open. Mm-hmm. He couldn't have been young army buddies with Bill Mulder in 1962, killing JFK in 1963, while already being a government agent colleague of Bill Mulder, interviewing that Zeus Faber submarine soldier earlier in 1953. That's a great point.
Yeah, well, that's why I think all of this is being told by Frohickey. You know, so there's like, I think what we're supposed to take away from it is that this is the way his life could be represented. Not that every single thing that he did from like a assassination perspective is true, but more that like he was involved in all of these sketchy things, literally had no life, had no friends, wanted to be a novelist, didn't work out. You know, like I think you're supposed to, that stuff is true.
Unless they did those interviews in the early 50s and then like, I don't know, got put in the army to do undercover stuff in the early 60s.
It's possible, but that's why in the beginning when we were talking about it, I was like, I don't think it's necessary to have Bill Mulder here from a storytelling perspective because it's just like he becomes friends with him later on in life. So like having him there is kind of like a little too cute.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I think the only 100% verifiable thing was the stuff that happens at the end, right? When we specifically see things from his perspective. So I would assume that the novelist stuff, and maybe that wasn't even, you know, colored by Frohickey. Maybe that was like actually stuff that was interspersed.
No, I think so. Yeah.
I don't know why that article would be like, oh, and also he's a novelist in his spare time.
No, and I do think that that's true from his investigation. But yeah, so basically Frohickey tells Mulder and Scully that he found all this out through a magazine article and he's going to investigate further to verify. But, you know, then they leave. But we basically see the cigarette smoking man at that point in his sniper position, like saying, like, I can kill you all whenever I want.
Yeah. And in a different version, he was going to. Apparently, mm-hmm. the original ending of this episode had him killing Frohickey.
Yeah, which would have not been good.
It would have been big for many reasons, right? That means he's not popping up in the spinoff.
Yeah. And he's also a character that you'll see as the series go on. But like he has the most heart out of all these guys. And I think that like his relationship even towards Scully is just really sweet. And it would be kind of a bummer if he wasn't there.
I would also say that, look, this episode did not necessarily make the cigarette smoking man more sympathetic.
No.
But like it would make him completely irredeemable.
Well, and also from the perspective of like, that's the out you're going to give this guy that you like built up. Like you're just going to shoot him at the end of an episode. Like so random.
Yeah. I should also mention that, you know, Morgan and Wong we talked about Space Above and Beyond last time, right? Because that was how they brought in the girl to play Melissa.
We mentioned it.
Yeah, but apparently this includes many references to that.
Oh, does it?
To that season left behind. Apparently, you know, Take a Chance is a reference to the series. The name Jack Colquitt is actually a name of one of the characters on that show. And actually, the guy who played Lee Harvey Oswald was an actor who was in that show.
Yeah, I mean, he looks like he could... That guy was like, could be you.
I mean, I guess waste
tall,
not...
skinny guy.
Waste not, want not.
No,
right?
It's true.
Like, if your show gets unceremoniously canceled, you say, yeah, like, I have all these resources. Let me
use
them.
I have all these random actors I can use.
Well, whether or not this story was true, I thought it was very... fun. It was fun in the way that, like, Jose Chung's was fun, where you're not supposed to take things completely seriously, and part of the fun is really trying to sift through what's BS and what's not to try to come out with a cohesive narrative.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, I don't think it's meant to be anything more than, like, a little bit more about the cigarette-smoking man. Not necessarily that you need to, I don't know every single detail about his past.
All right, well, we're going to get into... what I can say is definitely not the lighter of the two episodes,
nope.
Which is surprising considering we just got into an episode with multiple assassinations. But we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're talking Paper Hearts.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Angela, this is Strike 2.
Sorry.
I expressly came in and said, no bad things happening to children.
This is such a good episode, though. It's like, it's terrible, but it's terrible in a way that, like, is cinematically excellent.
It's a good type of terrible.
Well, yeah. And honestly, there's going to be more kid stuff. They just love to do kid stuff
on
this
show. It's a big horror thing, right? Children represent innocence.
I mean, you've seen Law... I mean, you probably haven't, but Law & Order SVU is, like, all about, like, that stuff.
I haven't seen it for that exact reason.
But I do think that... in this specific instance, I sort of forgot that's what it was about because the main through line is about Mulder and his relationship with his sister more than anything. So, you know,
it just happens to feature like a pedophile killer.
And that guy is wild.
Roche, I believe his last name is.
Yeah, his name is Roche, but the actor I'm saying is like, wow. So good.
He's really good. I mean, I believe that the episode was basically written and the role was cast with him in mind,
right? Yeah, so, and I don't know him from much else, but he was in mind for the role, specifically written for him.
Oh, what's his name? Tom Noonan. Yeah, I do believe there's one thing that we should know him for.
Well, he was in The Leftovers.
No, you know what we should know him for? Because we might know him from The Ripper and Last Action Hero. But Angela, you and I know him well as Frankenstein's monster in The Monster Squad.
Oh my God, yes! I knew his face was familiar, but I couldn't place it, and didn't do that much deep dive.
He's incredibly tall, right? Even when he's like 6'5".
He's like, what's his face from Star Trek? He's like Doug Jones. Doug Jones. He's like probably cast a lot as somebody who's like tall and creepy.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to him being he has a real basketball player height, which is maybe why we see him playing basketball later on. But yeah, he was made friends with the little... I mean... in one sense, he was killing little girls. In the Monster Squad, though, he was making friends with them.
He was the best in the Monster Squad. No, and the actor was, like, amazing in this. He played the role, like, perfectly.
All right, well, let's start with things, though, because essentially this episode...
Let's start with things.
On a very specific note, because this episode is essentially going to be Mulder following his dreams in many ways.
The beginning, I mentioned this to you when we were talking about it. So we watched this episode separately.
Yeah, that's a fun
first
fact.
Time we
so
didn't
we
watch
usually
it
watch them together, but because
with Angela, me sort of paying attention,
Angela was getting some much needed R&R.
Kind of.
we watched it separately, which is interesting because I think we both gleaned probably separate reactions
yeah.
from this. Or I would say it was interesting for me to watch this particular episode.
But
alone.
I did mention to you via text that the music in this episode is. I would say stands out a little bit from other episodes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's because of any sort of special music
no,
that was
I will,
done.
I will say I really liked the last song. That was the one that really
yes.
stood out to me. And I also believe that the composer was nominated for an Emmy for this episode. So you are not alone in your
yeah,
opinion.
Yeah, well, right in the beginning, right from the get-go, is that like doot-doot-doot-doot, that like kind of like video game sounding, mm-hmm. but like very mystical, very like otherworldly. And so it's basically, Mulder's having a dream where there's this little red dot. He follows the
yeah,
dot.
All right, let's talk about this because I could not get Tinkerbell out of my head.
I think it's supposed to be like that.
Yeah, because all I'm reminded of is if you ever see like a stage production of
yes,
Peter Pan,
yeah,
Tinkerbell is pretty much represented by a laser pointer.
Yeah, so I think it's supposed to be like that, that it's kind of like some mystical sort of
or
like
Ghost Rider.
Like a Will-O-The-Wisp or something, you mm-hmm. know? And so he's supposed to, he follows it, he follows the sign.
He's a little kitty cat.
It flashes and it says follow, right?
Yeah, the dot occasionally can turn into words, right? So like it turns into follow. When he gets to the park, it turns into Mad Hat.
Yeah.
And so basically he follows the laser like an animal to the body of a little girl in
but
the middle
not the,
of the woods.
Yeah, like the body of her like fully formed with her yep. hair and everything. And
then it forms into a shape
heart.
Of heart and then she sinks into the ground.
Yeah, and then he like pops awake.
Yeah, and so we start on like a very quick note as he like it follows this premonition, goes into
yeah.
where he went in his dreams. And this is at like 5 a.m. on a Sunday morning, right? He's
mm-hmm.
like in his casuals and they
he looks great, by the way.
I mean, he just looks pretty good. He's got the middle part going on.
That color t-shirt.
Yeah,
his casual wear is always great for me.
But they found something. It turns out his hunch was correct.
Yeah. And so they find the body of a little girl very much like decomposed.
Yeah,
like she's a skeleton.
And this also might be the first time I remember in an episode that we watched that we got like an abbreviated title sequence.
Yes.
I noticed it was much shorter. I didn't realize they did that.
I don't know if that's what they did at the time or if it's what they do on like Netflix, you know, like, yeah who knows?
Yeah. So I will say this is a big episode for Mulder, right? I know Spencer told us that essentially, while some feel that One Breath might be Mulder's
skull,
version
yeah.
of that big Scully episode from mm-hmm. season one, like, he feels that maybe that focuses a bit too much on like comatose Scully. This really is like
Mulder.
A big Mulder episode.
Well, and I also feel like his acting chops have improved since then.
Very
even
much so.
Since,
I mean, we've seen that the past few episodes.
Yeah, and even since that episode where they say like, oh, we developed this for acting, you know, like mm-hmm. in the field where I died. Like, I feel like that was this, the way he acts in this does actually create evocative emotion.
That being said, this is one of the most frustrating episodes to watch Fox Mulder. I think
yes.
I can say again it's not that I don't understand the character, it's just that he does frustrating things.
Well, and you're very sympathetic to him in this, which is like I think what makes it worse is that because you can almost like not blame him, but also there's a lot of talk about this episode being written as like Vince Gilligan was like, oh, let's investigate more Samantha. And like, what if she wasn't abducted by
right.
aliens?
So
like, let's create some mystery around that.
We should know, yeah, this is another Vince Gilligan episode where Soft Light was the first episode
yeah.
that he wrote, where clearly he likes to do like very off the beaten path things. And he is very much doing so, essentially turning the entire Samantha narrative on its head
yeah.
for an episode.
Yeah, but, you know, back to where Mulder basically has unearthed a little girl in the woods.
And so to that point, that was like sort of the first element of frustration for me was he does the thing, right, where they're like, oh, we're gonna dig it up. And he's like, no, I'll do it. I'm doing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, he gets like too antsy. Like he's like,
yeah,
basically
dude, like,
she's like, you have to wait. It takes time.
He could have punched a hole through her skull.
Also, he could have like completely like messed up crime scene information. Like, what
yeah.
if he is? So basically, we find out he knows right from the get-go that this is a victim of Roche.
Yes, because he once upon a time was put on this case. I'm assuming pre-Exiles,
yes.
right? When he
yeah,
was known as like the best criminal profile
yes.
around.
And so he profiles him, and he basically like he tells Scully in a scene later, basically that he is a serial killer who murdered 13 girls throughout the 80s. And it was his modus operandi was basically cutting out this heart from their pajamas.
Yeah, and also he would disguise himself as a vacuum cleaner mm-hmm. salesman. Basically, he'd like go door to door, say, "Oh, do they have a little girl I can kill in it?" Yes, that sort of
yeah.
chart, right?
Yeah, and then like basically. He confesses the guy is put behind bars. He confesses to 13 murders. They know who all the murders are, but something about the case has always bugged Mulder because he never found the hearts.
And so this is our typical Scully, well, actually explanation, right? Where she's saying, well, maybe these dreams are just because this has been bugging you.
Yeah. She basically says, Mulder, I don't think you're having prophetic dreams. I think you've never stopped thinking about this case.
Right. You're fixated on
which
it.
Which I agree with. I think that
I think both can be true.
I think both can be true. I think that he could be having some sort of prophetic dreams because he's come to the deduction in his subconscious. But either way, I mean, there's a lot to unpack here.
I also like Scully ends up quoting Mulder back, right? Yes. A dream is an answer to a question we haven't yet learned how to ask.
Exactly.
I can't remember which episode that showed.
Remember either.
But I know we definitely talked about it. But they decide to, you know, they drop in on this newly found little girl's father, which is really sad.
Well, also Scully deduces that these murders were happening much earlier than they originally thought. So starting as early as 1975, which makes Mulder have like a little like light bulb go off in his head.
Right, because he's like, what else happened in the 70s? That was
right, because the victim that they find is not one of the 13. So there's more than 13. And she does some like science shit on it and finds out she was killed earlier than that.
Yeah, so they drop by. I will say the little girl's dad also did a really, really good acting job in this scene as well.
Well, before that, they find the hearts, don't they?
Yeah, well, that's what they... No, this is when they haven't found the hearts yet.
Oh, they go to this guy first.
They just go to this guy and, like, tell her about it. Tell him about it.
Yeah, which was, like, really depressing because that guy was like, oh, are there other victims that you're seeing today? And they're like, oh. Like, there probably are. That's
he goes into this monologue, right, of like, I used to think that the missing was worse than the dead because you never know, but now I'm actually glad my wife died last year so she didn't have to experience this closure.
Well, because they never found her, but they also didn't know what happened to her, and I feel like finding out that she was, like, murdered by a total creep pedophile.
In this case, like, the truth is much worse than fiction.
Yeah, because they probably, I mean, in their minds, they could have made up some story that she just, like, you know, went missing, fell somewhere, like, you know, happen to, like, get into an accident. You never know, but, like, a pedophile is awful.
Absolutely terrible. So this is now where Mulder's going to have a flash from his dreams and say,
another little red light.
Because he's a traveling salesman, of course, he'd keep his possessions in his car. He finds out that
we need to find his car.
Yeah, and so his car was pawned off to this guy who essentially tried to turn into a hot rod with the flames painted on the side. And going off of just the Mad Hat idea, Mulder finds the top that was taken off the car, rips off the upholstery, and finds a copy of Adventures in Wonderland.
Yeah, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland.
Which is ridiculous.
Why is it ridiculous?
Like, I understand if he kept the hearts in there, why would he put them in the book Alice in Wonderland?
Because it's a creepy, like, he's obsessed with, like, children. It's a kid's book.
Yeah, I guess I think it's a better tome to keep things in than Adventures in Wonderland, you know?
What would you put, if you were a pedophile killer, like, how could we even imagine what he was thinking? Like,
I don't know, it's just a weird thing to be like, put them in a book and then put that book in the roof. You know, it feels like it's maybe one step too many.
So I think what happened is that he always kept them in the book. It's not that he was like, he put them all in the book and then put them in the roof.
Yeah, it reminds me a bit of like, I put that box in another box.
Yeah, no, but I think that for this, because they're in different pages. I think that's where he collected them and stored them. And then he would hide them in the car. You know, it's not like he was like, let me all hide this all at once. It was like he probably took that book out of there was probably like a way to get into that wasn't slicing it.
Well, I also wonder, you know, when he knew that he might get caught.
Yeah, he probably hid it in the roof of the car. Yeah, but like, he was always hiding the hearts in the book.
Right.
Yeah. And he always,
It was just, I think maybe putting the book in the roof was maybe the step too far. But again, if he thought that he was going to get caught, maybe he wanted to hide it instead of the glove compartment.
Yeah, exactly.
It was surprising me that Mulder was like, well, let me check the glove compartment. You don't think this dude who bought this car didn't clean it out of what might be in there?
That dude didn't seem like he cleaned a lot.
He had plans to turn into grease lightning.
Anyway, so they find the hearts and they're going to go see Roche because there are Three more, two more.
Because that was the 14th victim.
And two unidentified hearts, which is heartbreaking.
It's a little bit on like, paper heartbreaking. It's a little bit like Silence of the Lambs, right? Because the rest of this episode is going to be him working with a serial killer.
Yes.
In this case, though, it's to catch himself.
Yeah, which is like, this is something that he knows how to do from his past as a profiler and as an FBI agent, should not be fazed, but he basically immediately is taking it too personally.
Wait, he's going completely aggro. Though this first scene is them on the basketball court, and I am alarmed at how casual this is.
Yeah, so I think that this is like when somebody's in prison for a really long time.
Right, well, he's in prison for life, right? Scully says, yeah, like, you have nothing to lose.
Yeah, but I do think it's odd that they would let them interview him in a basketball court. Yeah, like it is a little weird.
We're just shooting some hoops. Why don't you go drop on?
Yeah, or like, oh, he's in the yard doing exercises. Why don't you go talk to him out there? Like, I don't know if that's how, maybe it worked that way in the 90s.
I mean, we're going to go to an interrogation room very soon. So
yeah, why didn't they just bring him there?
I think it was purely for the scene
where Mulder makes him a basket.
Tom Newman and David Duchovny play basketball.
Yes.
I did not realize this until I did research, but apparently David Duchovny like has some game to him.
Yeah.
He played basketball before.
No, he did, and he's like so sporty.
Yeah, the Mulder's sporty, but I didn't realize that David is similarly,
yeah,
you know?
He is similar sporty, and he immediately sinks a hoop, and basically Roche says like, oh, I'll talk to you if you can sink a basket from there.
Do you think in the prison, instead of playing horse, they play Roche? They have to spell that out?
No, I do not think that.
And then you kill the loser.
I don't think that, no.
But essentially the Roche says like, oh yeah, I'll give you information about who's out there, but it's in exchange for my heart's back.
Yeah, which is like a big, big no-no is negotiating with the murderer.
And so you wonder, why is Mulder so fixated on this? This is just a cold case from years ago, but another dream indicates that maybe there is more stakes,
yes,
to this than you may think.
Or, well, yeah. Yeah, well, Mulder thinks there might there be, yeah,
because
exactly.
we go into the living room and we essentially get like a line-for-line recreation of the day Samantha, mm-hmm, was taken. Very glad that David Duchovny is playing Mulder instead of Kid Mulder.
Yeah.
I want to hear Samantha.
Although that's how he would do it, too.
That's where, yeah. But this time he's saying, you know, not again, not again. And this is when everything comes together.
And this is a dream.
This is a dream, of course.
Mulder.
Because at the door now, instead of the alien, like we saw in the beginning of season two.
He thinks he remembers Roche.
Roche and his car specifically, that he was the one who accidentally abducted Samantha.
Yeah, but this is all happening in Mulder's mind, and I think that Mulder is always looking for the truth about Samantha, and honestly, we don't even find it out what happens to her, and I'll tell you this right now, we do not find out. Donut find out.
She got turned into a donut.
No, we do find out, but we don't find out until season 7.
Oh, really? So we do find out.
And there are multiple instances of this happening again,
right,
where it's like, maybe it's that.
Yeah, where it's like false endings,
yes,
almost.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so
they're constantly pulling the Samantha maybe was abducted by aliens, maybe she wasn't card.
Fertile ground detail,
I suppose.
So now we're back in the interrogation room. This is when Roche decides to unveil, oh yeah, I sold a vacuum cleaner to your dad back in the day.
Claims he was on Martha's Vineyard, claims to know all this information.
Mulder decks him.
Yeah, Mulder's just like very alarmed by this whole thing and just like punches him, which is like such a bad move.
And it's not helped by the guard at the moment being like, I didn't see anything.
Yeah,
you know?
But there's cameras.
And
like, then
what Skinner is going to point out later on.
But yeah, so he basically, Mulder freaks the fuck out at this point and has to go find his mom and ask her a bunch of questions.
And Scully, of course, is taking her Scully role here of, you're in too deep. She says that Roche was on the internet yesterday. He could have very easily looked up information about you. Almost like the way a psychic sort of profiles people, you know?
Totally. And I think that there's also, he knows Mulder from the case. Like,
yeah.
Mulder profiled him. Mulder's in his head. And he's in Mulder's head. You know, he knows Mulder because he is a weirdo who is probably really good at...
Okay, so let's talk about that. So then are you not a believer in the whole, like, nexus thing that Mulder comes up with?
I am to an extent in this episode, but I do think it goes hand in hand with Scully's understanding of the more you understand something, the more you research something, the more you become involved in it, it becomes part of you. So they're basically saying the same thing.
Yeah.
That the nexus is like, they're connected in a way that is like otherworldly. And Scully's saying, no, they're connected in a way that is, they are so involved with each other that they just know how one another thinks.
Yeah.
So I think it's the same thing. I just think one is based in sort of mythology and the other one's based in science.
Yeah, I mean, Spencer sort of compares it to other types of episodes, like Clyde Bruckman, for instance, where there are people who have these sort of psychic abilities.
Just a little bit more empathic.
In this case, though, it's just cutting out the middleman.
Yeah, and I think that this is a real thing. I mean, this is like me saying that I don't think that... I think having a sixth sense or naming it like ESP or something like that is like maybe taking it a step too far. But I do think there are people out there that are more intuitive than others. You know, people that are more in touch with like different wavelengths. I mean,
that's the show psych, right? Is that he's not a psychic. He's just very observant.
Yeah. And like also empathetic. Like I'm an extremely empathetic person to the point where if you're anxious and upset and stressed, I get anxious and upset and stressed.
It's very true.
And then I'm always just like, what's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? And you're like, nothing.
Until I'm forced to admit it, and then we both feel better.
Yes, exactly. So I do think that that's more probably what's happening, but that Mulder's going to believe, of course, in a more spooky thing.
Yeah, the worldly approach. I do like also Scully saying that Mulder walked in there with his heart on his sleeve.
Yeah, but he did, though.
Because in some cases, you can just pull that heart off the sleeve and add it to your collection in your book.
Yeah, but I mean, he did. He walked in there with an expectation that he was going to have questions answered. And he then got them answered and wasn't happy with the result.
So Mulder goes to visit Mommy. So did she move to Greenwich, Connecticut?
Yeah, I don't think... So Martha's Vineyard is where they would vacation. They had a house in Martha's Vineyard. And that is where they also... They lived in Massachusetts.
Right.
But... When her parents got divorced, or his parents got divorced, I think his mom just lives in Greenwich, Connecticut.
Oh.
I think that's where she lives.
Oh, right. So I'm thinking back to when...
And his dad lived in Massachusetts.
That's what I was thinking, because I was thinking back to when, quote-unquote, Samantha came back, and they were together in Massachusetts.
But that was at the dad, like the family house.
Yeah, exactly.
Who's to say what happened after she had a stroke?
Maybe that's what I was thinking as well, that, like, you know, she might have been moved to, like, a more hospitable environment.
Maybe.
Though that does make sense, because all of this old junk is in the basement, right? She can't be like, take all my priceless relics with me.
Yeah, so I do think, I mean, maybe who knows.
But essentially Mulder gets confirmed Roche's information, at least that there was a vacuum sold to her back in the day.
Yeah, which is a little wild. So I think that that probably is like the assumption that everyone had a vacuum sold to them back in the day.
Like,
the most popular model was the princess model, so he maybe just took a shot in the dark.
Like if you're like, describe the salesman to, because I think people would remember if the freakishly tall person sold them a vacuum.
Yeah, well, his mom is basically also saying she doesn't remember a lot because she had a stroke.
Oh, right, we're talking about a lamp or palm.
Yeah, exactly.
Only a couple weeks from that.
But, and then, I mean, he's just, like, upset by finding this vacuum. It's not good for his psyche.
You know who else is upset? Skinner.
Yeah, and as he should be.
As he should be, because
he's
Mulder
just trying to
hit
do
a criminal.
G-damn job.
Yeah.
And Mulder can't keep it together.
Yeah, I mean, he essentially says, you're forbidden from visiting this guy.
Yeah.
And Scully shouldn't have done this, but she steps in being like, oh, he has a reason to it. It's connected to Samantha. And Scully's like, I don't care.
Yeah,
at this point.
I mean, Scully's his BFF. She's got to stand up for him.
I know, but I just think that...
And he wants to... And she basically... Walter Skinner says... Walter. Why am I calling him Walter?
Oh, on a first name basis with him.
Yes, Walter. But he basically says, Scully didn't tell me. There's cameras, you idiot. Like, like making sure that he knows that Scully didn't, like, do something bad.
Yeah. So this is when, I believe... Despite this, Mulder does go back to visit Roche.
He basically convinces him that he needs to question him, and he lets Scully and Mulder go one more time to question him.
And this is where Roche is going to give more details, right? He mentioned Stratego. He talked about The Magician, which is the show that Fox didn't let Samantha watch.
Which is why I do think there is a little bit of, like, a psychic connection, because, like, how could he know all that stuff?
Unless he's being tipped off by someone,
maybe.
You know? But essentially, he says... Oh, there's this, you know, there's, I think I know where Samantha is. She's in this place in West Virginia. And so they trudge forward. Mulder and Scully dig up the body with their hands.
Yeah. So, I mean, he did tell them the location of a victim. It's just, it's not Samantha.
That's right. And he sort of misled them, right? But being purposely vague so that they were harried. But by the time they did it, they realized, oh, no, it's definitely not Samantha.
Well, because Scully does an autopsy and she knows that there's way it could be.
And Mulder also says that she broke her collarbone. This collarbone's intact. Bones don't fuse together after death.
Yeah, exactly. So... it's not Samantha, but they do find another victim, which I guess is good.
And back to Roche. And this is when Roche goes into like a really creepy monologue, right? Of, oh yes, she had mint plants outside. I remember standing in the mint plants and watching her.
He basically tells Mulder that Samantha definitely is the last victim.
Yeah.
And convinces him to get him out of prison.
Yeah,
to
he basically
go find
says
her.
Like, oh, all I want is a day of freedom. I'm not asking for much, but it's like, he is asking for much.
He's asking for a lot.
You know exactly what he's going to do, yet Mulder does it.
Yeah, so he basically has like a moment where he releases him from prison without anyone's permission, which is awful.
I feel like at least bring one more person with you. At least
but
bring
But he knows
backup.
Nobody's going to let him do it.
Maybe Scully, though.
Maybe. I don't think, though. I don't think she would let
him.
Have
one of the lone gunmen go with
you. Yeah, that's
true. You just need a warm body next to you, because what's going to happen later on is because he has no one else to look out for him, he gets completely hoodwinked.
Yeah, basically he gets knocked out and he steals his badge and his gun and his suit. And
but don't worry, before we get that, we have a nice little sequence of Roche pervert on a girl in the plane.
Oh yeah, it's so creepy. And then he basically says he has to go to the bathroom, but he gets up and he like is walking down the aisle and he starts asking this little girl questions, and it's like so upsetting.
It's like
it makes me like churning. And it also makes me so scared for like anyone talking to Asher ever.
That's why I don't like to watch these things.
I know, but we have to.
I suppose
this is the X-Files.
Yeah. So Mulder essentially takes Roche to that house that you were speaking about. I think this was the lamp, the summer house that we saw.
Yeah, so this is the summer house that is not the original
house. This is gonna be the trick where he says, oh, here we are at the crime scene of the crime. You tell me what happened. And so Roche goes into all that salacious detail and he says, aha, it joke's on you.
Didn't happen here.
Here's egg all over your face, sir. It didn't happen here.
Exactly. And he basically plans to bring him back to prison, but, you know, falls asleep, I guess, like has another dream about Samantha and then he's gone.
Yeah, exactly. So he basically has a dream like, oh, he found Samantha, and then everything just disappears. And it's as prophetic as well, because when he wakes up, they're gone. I wrote in my notes, I think up to this point, this is the worst thing Mulder has ever
done. It's pretty bad. Well, I mean, I'm sure
A serial killer not back only on the loose.
Not only that, but he let somebody who is like very clearly not rehabilitated and is going to go out
is
there.
Is in fact relishing in the crimes that he committed.
And it has no morality to him at all. Like, he let him out loose, basically. And it's when we find out that he has taken his gun and his badge and stolen a little girl from daycare.
Oh, God.
Yeah, fucked up.
It's really fucked up.
But, and then the woman, the poor lady is like, this is all my fault. And Mulder's like, no, this is my fault. And it's God you're taking ownership.
I will give at least a smidge of kudos to Mulder here for at least being like, he drops the Samantha thing immediately and says, okay, this takes much more precedence. A little girl's life is at stake right now.
Luckily, Scullery.
The Scullery.
Scully.
The Scullery maid.
Scully and Skinner arrive to help, and they're going to go find him.
Yeah.
This is like a creepy location, by the way.
Yeah, so, well, I was a little confused about the logic here, because Mulder, so Scully says, oh yeah, Roche used to have like sort of a burner
an apartment,
house here in Alice Avenue. He goes, yes. Because of the Mad Hatter, he was inspired by Alice in Wonderland to kidnap young girls.
Yeah. But I think he fixates on young girls.
Yeah, I don't think he's inspired by it, though. That's what Mulder's alluding to.
I think that he fixates on young girls, and that the idea of Alice in Wonderland, Alice specifically from Alice in Wonderland, is like nice to him. Like, he likes it because it's a girl.
Yeah, so much so that like he's
probably fixated on a lot of other things.
Purchasing property off of his fetishes.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think that I'm not sure that we can really get in the know of what a pervert serial killer
does.
I would
not like to personally.
No,
I'd like to sleep tonight. But yeah, to your point, essentially where the final scene ends up being is in a decrepit bus depot next to where Roche lived.
Exactly.
And so I guess they were just sitting there. I mean, because they said, you know, that Roche was coming for them. So was Roche just sitting there waiting
for Mulder? I think he was just running away at that point. And so he is waiting, and Mulder finds him because he sees something moving on the bus. Yeah,
but he essentially pulls an ultimatum here, right? He says, hey, if you kill me, you're never going to find out anything about Samantha. But wisely, Mulder decides to kill him. It's not worth it at this point.
It is a little bit of a bummer that they don't find that last body, because I do feel like that's like kind of sad for whoever. Yeah, but it's definitely not worth
it. But I personally don't think this had anything to do with Samantha.
No, no, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the victim and their families won't have closure.
Yeah, but I also think the daddy made an argument before, right?
Yeah, like, exactly.
That we don't know.
Yeah, so Mulder shoots him, and it's rough.
Yeah, and there's the final scene is them just sort of mulling over everything. Scully, there's a fun moment where Scully tells Mulder, like, hey, why don't you go get some sleep? And he literally laughs in her face.
Yeah, well, because he keeps having all these dreams where, like, Samantha gets abducted.
And he's also like, hey, I'm Fox Mulder, the guy that typically stays up for, like, 48 hours straight during episodes of The X-Files.
It's true. I mean, he literally has no bed in his apartment.
And so we spoke about it before, but we get this very haunting song playing as Mulder looks over that final cloth heart. Yeah. I should also mention, why is this called paper hearts instead of cloth hearts?
I don't know.
Is paper hearts a term?
Like, I think it is.
Hearts out of paper?
No, but I do think that the term paper hearts is a thing. Now I'm looking it up and I misspelled hearts. Paper Hearts is a song by Tori Kelly.
Okay, well, that's very much goes after The X-Files. Like, you make paper hearts,
book.
You know, in arts and crafts for, like, Valentine's Day.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's more of a saying than fabric hearts.
Yeah, fabric hearts would be a weird episode. It'd be very much like the...
BTS did a cover song of the Tori Kelly song, Paper Hearts.
Wow, this really must be, like, a big hit then.
Paper
Real
hearts meaning. What paper hearts mean? When you're searching and hoping for love, the right person isn't always the first one you come across. That's why
sometimes you have to dig
sense.
In West Virginia to find the
I
person
think that
you
might
want.
Just be lyrics from the Tori Kelly song.
Oh, really? Well, we're really doing a deep dive on digging up.
So, yeah, we don't know anything.
Yeah, but I agree. Paper Hearts, I think, is more of a thing. It just doesn't
it
really
just sounds
apply
better.
To it. I mean, listen, we talked about a lot of X-Files episodes where the titles don't necessarily apply on a one-to-one basis.
Also, I do feel like the Paper Heart is more flimsy and, like, mm-hmm. there's more, like, sort of, like, fragility to
Ooh,
it,
I
maybe.
Like that. And also, I will say that personally, the haunting children's choir at the end very much reminded me, I know you don't know this because we've had this conversation before, but there's a Christmas cartoon that's from London or from the UK called The Snowman, and it has like a solemn children's choir.
You know how
singing.
I feel about Christmas cartoons.
Yeah, going, we're walking in the air.
Stop, so loud.
It's about a boy who makes friends with a snowman. It's one of those things that I'll always remember. It's like
this
very,
is like a little known fact, but I don't love Christmas cartoons.
Really? You hate
Claymation?
The
no, thank you.
I mean, you're not the only one, though.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's
creeps
it's
me
one
out.
One of the rare things that you and I disagree on.
Yeah, you love that shit.
But that's all we could, that's all, you know, that puts us on happier notes from the way that things end
I
here
guess so.
as we end off two very dark episodes of
The
X-Files.
Very dark. But I do feel like the first one is done in a way that is more tragic than dark.
Yeah. So
and this one is just dark.
Yeah. So Spook of the Week, I think Cigarette Smoky Man has to be the one for the first one, right?
I suppose, yes. And then Roche, obviously.
I mean, Roche might be the biggest spook of the week that's ever spooked.
Yeah. No, he's actually scary.
Yeah, like, he's like legitimately terrifying.
It's funny because when I think about the X-Files, I don't ever think about him, probably because I try to like get it out of my mind.
Yeah,
but
exactly. He's not
there's
the person you
one
want.
Character that I do think about that we didn't watch that episode, and he's like a creepy like stalker guy who like profiles Scully.
Oh,
and
yeah, you told me about that one.
Tries to like take, he likes to like wash women's hair, and so he like abducts prostitutes and like kills them and like rips their fingernails off and like really creepy shit.
Dwayne Barry was pretty creepy too.
Dwayne Barry's very creepy. Eugene Toombs is very creepy, but I always think about the ones that are like too real because the one that I'm talking about happens after Scully's abduction, like after so it's like she's like sensitive still from being abducted,
and that's what I find interesting about this episode as well, is that this is, I mean, again, you said that there might be some sci-fi aspects to it, but
no, but
really
it's real. It's
face,
like SVU.
It's much just a crime scene investigation
and
show.
I think that's why it hits harder, which is why I think it's a really good episode of The X-Files too. I mean, it's like it touches upon stuff that's more paranormal, but it is embedded in like the heart of what these characters are, which
it's incredibly
moving.
Well made and unsettling, which is what it's aiming for.
It's what it's aiming for. Plus, I would say David Duchovny, this is like primo acting. Like he does such a good job.
He's not given like, he's not doing the full sit down and go into this tearful monologue like
I don't like
Fulwera
I
guy.
Also don't like, this is maybe a hot take, but I don't love when he cries. Like I always feel like it's not as genuine, whereas like Gillian Anderson has a really good big cry, like it's very natural looking. Mulder has a squinty sort of like ugly cry. She's just able to make tears fall, and he's clearly not.
I wouldn't make David Duchovny cry, according to Angela. Maybe I just did. Pretty sight.
No, but I mean, just in the X-Files so far, we haven't seen an emotional episode from him that wasn't like, I don't want to say forced crying, but like...
No, very much like histrionics.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Either whereas this is like very internalized.
Very angry, screaming, or he's like weeping.
Yeah, this is like internalized, almost like depression to an extent.
Yeah.
It's like really sad. But yeah, I mean, we'll find out about Samantha later on. I'll tell you this. This wasn't her heart.
Yeah. So,
spoiler alert, not really.
Let's move on here to hopefully lighter and better notes next week. So we're only doing one episode, but if I am to be believed, it is a big one. We are doing season 4, episode 14, Memento Mori?
Yeah, I mean, that's what you say. It's like...
Like Mori, so, like you're not the father?
No, Memento Mori is an art term.
Oh.
And I know this because I have a degree in art, in art history. But it's basically like, it's symbolic reminder of death.
Oh, interesting.
So if you ever look at any of these paintings, like from like the Renaissance or whatever, and there's like a skull in the corner, it's meant to like... Yeah, Scully in the corner or like something like that. It's basically just meant to like show you that death exists. It's like, it's always symbolic of death. So it's a memento mori. It's a reminder that we all die.
Okay. Well, then forget what I said about things getting onto a lighter
they
note.
They appear in funeral art a lot.
Okay. Well, I'm intrigued as to what that's going to be, considering how death seems to lurk everywhere in the X-Files. That is seemingly no different.
Well,
but.
I'll give you a hint. It has a lot to do with Scully.
Ooh, okay. So there will be a Scully in the corner. I'm excited about this. I hear this is one of like the big episodes of the X-Files.
A lot happens.
Yeah, so that's why I think we're going to focus on it singularly.
And
as
the
well.
Episode previous to this we're skipping, which is an episode where a tattoo comes to life.
Oh, no! So as we look at both of our arms.
So you'll be happy to know we're skipping the tattoo episode.
Listen, I faced too much real life stuff in this past week, okay? I need another one where I fear my tattoo has come to life.
Yeah, basically there's like ink in a tattoo and it poisons you to hallucinate your tattoo is like and makes you kill people. So
Oh okay well that's
good stuff.
Certainly intriguing. Well, I can't wait to get to season 4 episode 14 with you next week, Angela. Of course, if you have any thoughts about these episodes, feel free to write in xfiles@postshowrecaps.com, bloomfiles@postshowrecaps.com. you should also check us out on our Patreon Discord. There's some chatter about X-Files there. And the reason why I'm pimping out the Discord is for a couple of reasons, and the Patreon program in general. First, it's the start of a new month, and you're going to get a bang for your buck when you enroll in their program at patreon.com/postshowrecaps right at the top, considering that the membership auto-renews basically at the beginning of every month. You basically get a full month's worth before things roll over again. But the other big reason is because Josh Wigler, our Skinner, our man in charge, just announced a new goal. We are only, I believe, 22 patrons away from reaching 500 patrons at the moment, and that is too delicious of a goal to not commemorate with. Josh Wigler has said, if we get to 500 patrons on Post Show Recaps by the end of May, he will do a season 1 rewatch podcast of the show 24. 24, if you do not know, is one of Josh Wiggler's
shows.
And so I talked to him, we figured, let's put out the plug here, because maybe some fans of the X-Files, if they loved the Fox programming, would have liked 24 as well. If that appeals to you and you are not yet a patron of Post Show Recaps and you have the means to do so, we'd love to have you. There's a bunch of stuff going on there in addition to all of the patron-only podcasts, and hopefully this 24 podcast will be included in that soon. Again, patreon.com/postshowrecaps. You can also follow us at Post Show Recaps, at A Mike Bloom Type, at Ange Pelagi. But that's going to do it for this week. Again, we're going to be back next week covering Memento Mori. We're a little over halfway through season 4, and I'm hopeful that maybe things get a little lighter. Okay, well, I will continue to take out my umbrella and flash it a couple times as we continue through season 4.
I will say that the happier episodes are not as good in season 4, so like I just mentioned, the tattoo one is kind of funny.
Well,
I'm really
happy to be... sad when it comes to watching these X-Files episodes, especially alongside you. So again, next week, Memento Mori. We'll be back next week talking about that. Until then, case closed.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.